There's a whole lot of talk about mountains now, aren't there? The ones out west. The ones with not enough snow for ski events in the Olympics. The ones that are hopeful to be able to get all that is necessary in the next 3 weeks accomplished. Whether you like mountains or not, there's something about mountains that attract us. Wouldn't you agree? There's something about mountains that speak majestically about power, about longevity, about beauty that we can only stand in awe of. In the Bible, mountains are often used almost exclusively to indicate that there's something special taking place in God's encounter, intersection with humanity, with persons, with a people, with a purpose, with a message. So whenever we have stories about a mountain, we are invited indeed to pay attention and to see in particular what message is being disclosed in this metaphor. I may have shared with you before, in fact, I know I've shared with you before about my own mountaintop experience and close encounter with God, but not of the sort and kind I would like to repeat anytime soon. We had taken a trip, Wendy and I, out to Alberta, went to Jasper, and I was, the day was getting late, but I wanted to make that run up the gondola and that trek that goes up to the other peaks along the ridge. Everybody was doing it, and I thought, you know, if I hurry, I could get back in time for the gondola going down and the schedule and so forth. Foolish me. You know what happens when you go high up in the mountain, right? Chris is from Vancouver. He knows. The air is thin. And in thin air, you want to do anything but rush. Foolish me. I rushed and I was going, passing people thinking, boy, I'm young and strong and good. Look at these slow pokes, you know? It wasn't very long before I couldn't breathe. I really could not breathe. In fact, I thought, well, something's wrong. And I stopped and I kind of stumbled down a little ridge and I was gasping for air. And then I'm looking up at those people I thought were kind of stupid and slow, wishing somebody would come and help me. But I have to tell you that I really, really felt that I was dying. I could not catch my breath, and I said, oh my goodness, on this mountain, here I go. Close encounter with God. Not that kind I want to repeat again. Our stories in the Old Testament, in the first lesson and in the Gospel, are about encounters with God of a sort that perhaps were terrifying and a little bit mysterious and mystifying, but nonetheless potent and powerful for us. In the first reading, we hear of Moses going up on the mountain. 40 days on the mountain he spent. Always pay attention to periods of time with 40 in them. It is a cleansing, a trying, and a deepening time indeed. And Moses is there on behalf of the people because they're afraid to encounter God. And Moses is given the benefit and the blessing of God's presence to such an extent that God chooses to use him as an emblem in return to the disobedient, grumbling people by displaying on his face some indication and sign that he had been profoundly in the presence of God, and he comes back. Now that story is significant for what we read in the Gospel, because Jesus goes up to the mountain calling three of his inner circle of disciples to go with him. And what has he gone to do? This is really, really important, especially in Luke's Gospel. Anybody remember from the reading what has Jesus gone to do? To pray. Luke is the Gospel writer that most indicates and illustrates Jesus' commitment to pray. Pray, pray, and invites others to join in prayer. It is while he is praying that something happens, like Moses. Something radiant, something changes in his face. He's transfigured and his clothes are shining. And that encounter causes the disciples who have come, whom we're told are half asleep, to wake up and notice something about that presence. It feels almost violent to try and speak and describe it because it is mysterious And it is meant to draw us into a level of reflection and experience that words sometimes cannot convey. And yet that is all we have to some extent to speak about this and of it. And so let us speak briefly about this transfiguration and what it means for you and for me. The way the story develops it and what the disciples come to realize. We're given clues about its significance because of what the text says. While this is going on, we're told that two figures appear with Jesus on the mountain. One of them is Moses and one of them is Elijah. In Jewish history and in the Bible telling, we know that Elijah and Moses both were caught up, as it were, had the experience, if you will, of being fully in the presence of God. They also represent the law and the prophets. But notice what they're talking about. They are there together, and it says they were discussing his departure. In Greek, the word is exodus, and what was going to be accomplished in Jerusalem. They're talking about his identity and his purpose. The transfiguration, the glory of God, gives the people and those who will now witness this story a glimpse of who God is in Jesus and what Jesus is going to do. Just a glimpse. And it happens in the middle of his ministry, not at the end as a climax, but in the middle, because that glimpse of God's glory in Jesus is meant to sustain not only Jesus, but also his disciples in the mission that he's going to call them to, as well as you and me. Any of you, when you're reading a book, you can be honest, you can tell me, skip ahead to the end to see how it ends? Any of you do that? There's a few people who do. Some say, no, you can't do that. Especially if it's a mystery, you know, you'll ruin the tension if you know who done it. But I know there's some of you, and sometimes I do that, I skip ahead to see how it all ends. Because sometimes that helps you make sense of the story. Some of you may be familiar with Thornton Wilder's play, Our Town. It's a three-act play, very simple and ordinary, as it were, about two families in a town in New Hampshire at the beginning of the last century. And it goes through, the first two acts go through ordinary things of life. The kids, the parents have trouble getting the kids up from sleeping off to school. They play together, they join together, these two families know each other, and then eventually Emily and, I forgot the other guy's name, Webb is it? Anyway, Emily and the fellow, they get married. And that's the end of the second act. And then the third act. In the third act, it opens with Emily standing in a grave, by a graveside in a cemetery. And we realize as the play unfolds, that Emily has died. And others are gathered around at her funeral. And Emily wishes that she could go back in time to appreciate life more fully. And she's granted this wish, and she goes back till she's 12 years old. And she's part spectator and part person in the story once again. And she's trying to talk with her family, saying, Mom, stop preparing breakfast. Just come and talk with me. I have a story to share with you. Trying to invite the people that she has known and loved to pay attention to the ordinariness of their lives and how they are pregnant times with deep beauty and possibility and things that are taken for granted. The people do not listen. They go on with their lives. Finally, Emily can't take it anymore, and she goes back to the graveside. When James and John and Peter witness what Jesus experiences, they have a glimpse of how it's all going to end. They have a glimpse of the glory of God that is going to be made manifest in the death and resurrection of Jesus and at the end of all human history. They have a glimpse of how this whole business of life is meant to be lived. That glimpse is found in the identity and the mission of Jesus. When Jesus speaks, that is why the cloud, which represents God, says to them, listen to him. When Jesus says, love one another as I have loved you. When Jesus says, love your enemies. When Jesus says, give and share and forgive and be merciful. When Jesus talks about the blessings that come to those who have the capacity to mourn with those who mourn and weep with those who weep. When Jesus says all of these things, we begin to get a glimpse of how life not only is to be lived in the interim, but how it will all end. And it is not meant to rescue us from daily living, but it's an invitation to pay attention. Pay attention to your relationships. Pay attention to the cry of your soul for God, because all of us want an encounter with God. This story is about an appetite that each of us can relate to. Surprisingly, an unbidden God comes and discloses God's identity in Jesus Christ, and there is a powerful gift of grace. But what we realize is that you don't have to go to a mountain to experience this. Barbara Brown Taylor, in her latest book, An Altar in the World, A Geography of Faith, has a wonderful line. It says that all the world is the house of God. Paying attention to creation, to your work, to your creativity, to your relationships, to your calling, to the things that seem so ordinary and mundane. Because as you unearth and look and pay attention, you see a glimpse of God. You see a glimpse of your purpose. You see a glimpse of the needs in the world that require your faith, your energy, your skill, your commitment, your followership. So when we look at this story, we ask, whose transfiguration? Yes, it is about Jesus' transfiguration, but it is also about the possibility of having glimpsed that glory, having glimpsed how life ought to be. We too are transfigured. Came across a story in the newspaper, some of you may have seen it, this past week. The story of how a soul is set free, of how there's a transfiguration in the lifestyle and in the apprehension of life of a person. I'm going to read portions of it for you. It says, the title is, Money Does Not In Fact Buy Happiness. Man Dumps Fortune. Any of you see that? An Austrian tycoon is giving away all of his $5 million fortune after realizing that his riches were making him unhappy. Now, I know there's some of you saying, well, pass it my way. I'll learn how to be happy with that. You know, I know that's what you say, but let's hear what he's saying. Karl Rabiter, 47, a businessman from Telfs near Innsbruck, is in the process of selling his 3,000-square-foot villa with lake, sauna, spectacular mountain views. Mountain views. Ooh. Over the Alps, valued at $2.3 million. Also for sale is his beautiful old stone farmhouse in Providence with 42 acres on the market for $1 million. Already gone is collections of 6 gliders, valued at $600,000. Mr. Rabiter has also sold his interior furnishings and accessories business. He says, my idea is to have nothing left, absolutely nothing. Money is counterproductive, it prevents happiness. He will move out of his alpine retreat into a small wooden hut in the mountains or a simple bedsit in Innsbruck and survive on $1,300 a month, while the proceeds will go to a charity that he set up in Latin America. It's a microcredit charity. He says, for a long time I believed that more wealth and luxury automatically meant more happiness. I come from a very poor family where the rules were to work, to make more, to achieve more material things, and I applied this for many years. But over time, a conflicting feeling developed. More and more, I heard the words, stop what you are doing now, all this luxury and consumerism, and start your real life, he said. I had the feeling I was working as a slave for things that I did not wish or need. I have a feeling that there are a lot of people doing the same thing. For years, he said he was simply not brave enough to do it. And the tipping point came at a three-week holiday he spent with his wife in Hawaii. He said they were in the best all-inclusive. They spent a lot of money. And he goes on to say that they met people who weren't real, everybody pretending to be important, and the staff pretending to be friendly, only doing so because they were told and they got well paid. And it was all very phony, he said. They were actors. All the money that will go from my proceeds will go into a microcredit charity. Since deciding to sell up, he's felt free and the opposite of heavy. But he did not judge those who chose to keep their wealth. I do not have the right to give any other person advice, he said. I was just listening to the voice of my heart and my soul. I believe that a glimpse of the glory of Jesus may move in different directions. It may not move you or move me to give up. Well, I don't know if you have any millions. I certainly don't. But it may move you to notice something about your soul's appetite and deep desire for life that you've not noticed before. It may be that God is calling you and me to be transfigured by catching a glimpse of this Jesus, whose identity and purpose it is to involve and immerse himself intimately in the life of the world, in your life and my life. Don't you long for a peace like that? Don't you long for a glimpse like that? Don't you long to be your best self, your true self, not your pretend self? Don't you long to be purposeful and to matter in this world? Be transfigured. Take up the invitation. I want to invite us, because I really believe that the last word about this text should be silence. I want to invite us into a time of silence now, if I may. I'm going to say a few words, but then leave a pregnant pause for us to ponder well what the Spirit is saying. The Spirit who is here with us has much more to say to you than I do. So if you feel comfortable, close your eyes, take a deep breath. In the silence of this moment, strip away all of the ways you prop up your identity. Go deeply, go deep. Listen to the whisper, or perhaps by now it is a shout, of your soul. What is your soul crying for? What is the most urgent need you are identifying now for you to be true to your truest self? Stay with that. It may be scary, it may be unwelcomed, but pay attention. What is your soul crying for? What will give it life and help it live? Jesus comes not to do violence to that cry, but to assist it and nurture it and bring it to life, so that you and I may follow in the way of God, the way that will bring blessing to this world. Let in this now period of silence, the encounter of God and your soul's cry have some time together.